Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The first 100 days of a presidential administration has come to serve as a benchmark for the success of how a newly minted chief executive is doing. The practice began with FDR. In his first 100 days, he and the 73rd Congress enacted 15 major pieces of legislation, along with 62 other laws to address the Great Depression. That flurry of activity set a precedent. Roosevelt also signed 99 executive orders in his first 100 days. His actions were widely regarded as transformative, while others argued his policies were sometimes contradictory or lacked a clear direction. Still, FDR set the bar. By comparison, Donald Trump's first 100 days have also been transformative, but one characterized as chaotic, economically self-destructive, a period in which we have alienated traditional allies, and one marked by the signing of 139 executive orders in just the first 75 days, many of them legally questionable. Depending upon how you count, today marks the 100th day of Trump's second term. There is no question that he has used the time to make good on many of his campaign promises, deporting migrants en masse, slashing government agencies, and wiping out diversity initiatives. But public opinion has cratered. Trump's 41% approval rating is the lowest for any chief executive at this point in their tenure. Just 22% approve of his handling of the job, with 45% disapproving. That's just one poll. There are many. Overall, Americans' confidence in Trump to use his power responsibly stands at 46%. It's reached the point where conservative columnist Bret Stephens, has characterized this track record as the worst in history. This hour, we take a closer look at these first 100 days and what they have wrought. We are joined by Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history and chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College. Reuben Jones is a Washington reporter for Spectrum News, covering national and North Carolina politics. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you all. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be with you.
So, Michael, I'm going to put it on your shoulders. How would you describe these first 100 days?
Consequential, unprecedented, and if you're looking at it through partisan lenses, deeply divisive. I think, you know, certainly Trump 2.0 is a different beast than what we saw in Trump 1.0. But it's due to the fact that he learned his lessons in the first administration, and he came out guns blazing and told people exactly what he was going to do. And by God, he has done it, whether you like it or not.
And I'm going to bet, Reuben, that when you walk through the halls of the Capitol, opinions of the first 100 days are divided strictly along partisan lines. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, very much.
Okay. Trump says he is accomplishing what he campaigned on, but he campaigned on lower prices on day one, ending inflation, ending the Ukraine war on day one, which he has now said, well, he was saying that in jest, restoring the economy, which, by the way, wasn't broken. But what he's done is gut government agencies, cut federal programs, alienated allies, caused losses in the stock market, deported individuals in ways that seem to ignore the law. Is this, Michael, what people voted for? And if it isn't, what are the political implications of that?
I think certainly for his base, and I think the public opinion polls show this, his base is very much supportive of this dynamic that he has brought to his second administration. And I think we're seeing the, as you noted with Reuben, the divisiveness of the partisan takes on all of this. So I think, you know, what we know from Trump in his first administration was consistency is not the rule of the day. It's very much confusion, chaos. That's the way he tends to govern. He likes to keep people guessing. He likes to continuously be frontline in the news and in the headlines. And the only way to do that is to be inconsistent at times, but to be very aggressive and to be very bold in some of these policy decisions.
It
And
is a
so,
different. I'm sorry.
go ahead.
I was going to say it's a different style, and it's one that is relatively destabilizing and unsettling for many people. And sometimes being unsettling is not a good thing, particularly when it comes to the economy. Reuben, I know that Democrats are positively apoplectic about all of this and what's happening beyond the first term, now the second term. What about Republicans behind the scenes? They're all in lockstep in front of the scenes, as it were. What's it like behind the scenes? What are they saying? Anything?
I think depending on the Republican, there are a lot different conversations that happen off camera than happen on camera. There are a number of skeptical Republicans, I think, especially on the issues of Ukraine and the issues of tariffs. I can tell you, I've spoken with a lot of Republicans over the past few weeks, and it's pretty much unilaterally behind Trump publicly. Where there is potentially some concern is on the question of tariffs. A number of Republicans will tell you that, I don't like tariffs, but I trust the president because he's going to line up these trade deals. Now, the reality is, and you hint at those polls, Mike, the president's policies on tariffs are really just at barely have even started in terms of the potential impact. And as if economists, what economists say is that this will result in higher prices, that's not going to come for weeks and months until down the road. Will Republicans stay locked in and united behind the president when those prices start to increase? That's where the questions start to come. Because as we all know, the economy is what drives voters to the polls. And if the economy does, in fact, go sour, it's going to be a lot harder for Republicans to stand behind this president, even if they are very, very much behind him right now.
Mary, we live in this kind of Democratic bubble because there's only two Republicans in office in all of Mecklenburg County, well, in Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte, because there are two city council people on city council who are Republicans, although one has departed temporarily to go to Washington and will be replaced by a Republican because that's the law. But have local people been talking about this? And is it all against what Donald Trump has done? Or are there some people out there that you've spoken with who say this is he's doing a pretty good job. He's doing what we elected him to do.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely on people's minds. As you mentioned, obviously, this is a very blue community, so the feedback tends to be pretty negative. That being said, there are members of local Republican coalitions who are very pleased. The Mecklenburg County Republican Party is under new leadership that's really trying to have more of a public presence, and they've been sending out regular statements praising the president for his executive orders on the Department of Education, other economic policies. So there are certainly people who agree with it, but I think a lot of the feedback has been relatively negative in such a Democratic city, especially when you see so many programs, governmental and non-governmental, that are now dealing with a lot of uncertainty because of all these policy shifts we've seen in the first 100 days.
I referenced the latest poll numbers, which change almost daily, but I've referenced them at the beginning of the show just to give people some perspective on what those poll numbers are really like. Let me tell you where presidents have stood in their first 100 days historically. It's a lot of numbers, so try to stay with me. Eisenhower, that's back in the 50s, had a 73% approval rating at this stage of the game. JFK, 83%. Nixon, 62%. Carter, 63%. Reagan, 68%. George H.W. Bush, 56%. Clinton, 55%. George W. Bush, 62%. Obama, 65%. Biden, 57%. Trump's popularity right now, according to CNN, is about 41%. A Washington Post ABC News poll has him at 39%. Some polls have him lower in terms of popularity and in terms of concerns over the economy and his leadership in general. Trump has said that those people conducting these polls are, quote, negative criminals. He called them, quote, fake polls from fake news people that should be investigated because they are truly enemies of the people. Reuben, has there been a reaction among politicians in Washington to either the polls or Trump's reaction to them?
We'll see. Congress just got back yesterday, second half of yesterday after a 2-week recess. This is when they'll start getting grilled by reporters about how they think the first 100 days has gone. Mike, I'll say this. The president has been known for being watching poll numbers very closely. And so he may say publicly that he doesn't trust them. It's very likely he is looking at them, though. And what you've seen the White House do in recent days and recent weeks is really emphasize the issue of immigration. Outside of the White House right now, there are, I think it's about 100 different signs of mugshots of undocumented migrants who have been arrested and charged with certain crimes around the country. This is an issue the White House feels they have the American support on, and the polls have shown his numbers are a little higher on immigration than the economy, for example. Now, so you can expect him to continue to press that issue. You know, the issue of DEI, he's had some support on as well. But on the issues of the economy, on the issues of these federal worker cuts and some of the cuts that we've seen in the government, that's where he's struggling. And so it'll be interesting to see how the president frames this over the next few weeks. But right now, they're really focusing in on immigration.
Yeah, they've lined the White House driveway from the, I guess, the gate to the portico with these signs that say arrested and photographs of people that they have arrested and are planning to or have already deported. And they put them in the line of sight of all the cameras that are set up for all the networks along that drive to do their evening reports. These are, Michael, the lowest poll numbers for any president in their first 100 days in history. Can you recover from numbers like these?
You can, I think, if Americans' perceptions of the economy overall can improve. And generally, presidents want the economy to be good, particularly going into a midterm election year that will generally be a referendum on the president and the party in power. And right now, Republicans control the levers of government. They control the White House. They control both chambers of Congress. So they are going to be the ones being held accountable for, you know, how Americans view the direction of the country. And we know that the economy, pocketbook issues, will be the dominant factor when people go to the polls. So right now, if the midterm election was held today, it probably would not be good for Republicans. They've got a year or a little bit over to kind of hope that things rectify and stabilize and public opinion improves. But, you know, once you start getting things set in this polarized environment, it's going to be hard to change a whole lot of minds.
Catawba College, your institution, recently conducted a poll which reveals that North Carolinians are evenly divided about whether they approve or disapprove of Donald Trump, but they're fairly united on what they believe the impact of tariffs will be. Have about a minute. Share some of those numbers if you can.
Yeah, this was back in March, so it's about a month old, but evenly divided on approval, disapproval for Trump. But they understood what tariffs could do. They understood that prices will likely increase. And so I think the views on the economy are decidedly negative in this state, and we'll have to continue to watch that moving forward.
And since he says he's doing what he said, and Republicans are saying he's doing now what he said he would do when he was campaigning for president, why have his poll numbers fallen so precipitously, Michael?
Well, because probably public opinion is not behind all of these issues and concerns that he has focused on. So we'll have to, you know, kind of watch this play through over the next year and 15 months or so.
So when we come back, we'll take a look more deeply into the impact of these first 100 days and some of the things that the Trump administration has been engaged in since January 20th, because he wasted no time. He began on day one. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the first 100 days of the second Trump administration with Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history and chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College. Reuben Jones joins us. He is a Washington reporter for Spectrum News One. And Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Mary, I referenced the fact that Donald Trump's reaction to the recent polls, he called them fake polls from fake news people that should be investigated because they are truly enemies of the people. Not the first time he's called the media enemies of the people. He has this love-hate relationship with the media. He loves being on television, and he loves being covered, particularly when the news is good, not when it's bad. And it is popular for politicians of all stripes to throw the media under the bus, but he has escalated the rhetoric beyond what he did in the first administration. This time, he's not just saying bad things about the media. He is suing news organizations and networks and threatening to take broadcast licenses away because he doesn't like the content of their coverage. And his threats are resonating within the industry. The producer of 60 Minutes resigned last week because of pressures alleged, he alleged, were being exerted on the program by honchos at CBS, who are trying to sell the parent company. Paramount is trying to sell the company, and they need the Trump administration's approval for that sale. He has banished the Associated Press from the White House because they refuse to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. Other news organizations have been pulled out or banished from the Pentagon. Are working journalists and their organizations responding to this?
I think my impression, and again, working at the local level, obviously I'm a bit separated from folks who are working in, say, the White House pool on a regular basis, but I think there is a sense of solidarity amongst journalists in terms of, you know, wanting to preserve access and be that fourth estate and, you know, just continue to do the good work. I think it's so hard these days in a very fractured media landscape to really kind of convey to communities sometimes the value of quote-unquote traditional journalists who are sort of doing things outside of the more sort of flashy, maybe more popular with the younger generation, new media landscape. Obviously, we've seen the Trump administration trying to make a big show of incorporating more new media into the White House press corps. That being said, you know, one of the organizations that was listed under new media this week was the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is one of the oldest news organizations in the United States. So not exactly anything new there. But yeah, and just trying to be innovative in terms of strategy, you know, figuring out ways to tell the high quality journalism we've always done in ways that are going to reach today's audiences.
Reuben, I know you primarily cover Capitol Hill, correct me if I'm wrong, and you're not part of the White House press pool, but the White House press pool has been augmented by these new media outlets, which is another way of saying media that is friendly to the president, because many of the questions that they ask at those afternoon press conferences are their gimmies. They're really softball, more than softball questions. They're setting up the press secretary to give the company line. What's the reaction to that among journalists in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I do cover the White House some, and okay. I will say there are a number of reporters in the briefing room now that are not a traditional reporter in the sense of they do have a certain agenda that they are trying to fill. So that makes for sort of an awkward briefing setting sometimes. I will say, Mike, that I was at the White House Correspondents Association dinner over the weekend, and it was a lot different feeling than it is in previous years. There was no comedian. The president did not speak. And I think not having a comedian maybe fit the moment in the sense of it was all focused on journalists. It was journalists receiving awards and speaking about the importance of independent work. It was focused on the scholarship recipients, which is actually what the dinner is supposed to be about. College students who are learning about the world of journalism and what it's like to cover it in Washington. And so it was a different, maybe more somber mood than years past. What they did do, Eugene Daniels, the president of the Correspondents Association, showed clips of previous presidents who had spoken, Democrat and Republican, and talking about the importance of the media. So it's a different time. It is an unusual time. It is a bit of an awkward time up here, for sure.
Michael, that's the positive spin on the White House correspondents' dinner over the weekend. It made for very bad television because it was for the people in the room almost exclusively, as opposed to presidents getting up and making fun of themselves and making fun of the press, and the press doing the same in reverse. But it's become a kind of American tradition. It's part of in our DNA. Donald Trump never attended the White House press dinner in the first 4 years. He was there, I think, for one of the Obama years, and they made fun of him, and he's never recovered from that. What does that say about where we're headed? The fact that the White House correspondents canceled the comedian because she might have made fun of the president, and that would not have been good.
Well, I think it speaks to a broader issue. The fourth estate, the media, is inherently a unwritten checks and balance within our democratic republic. They are tasked with being the accountability folks that keep people true to what their government service should be. And I think, in this age and in this era, there are kind of evolving two dynamics at play. One is you capitulate to the president's bullying, or you stand up to him. And I think people are starting to recognize standing up to him is something that is inherently part of our civic culture in society and in America, but it's going to bring real risks to the people that do stand up to the president, that he will use his bully platform, that he will use the bully pulpit to call them out and to attack them even more viciously. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where we are in terms of a very deeply divided dynamic in our country.
Mary, the stock market is not the economy, but Trump's impact on the stock market has been dramatic, with enormous gyrations brought on mostly by uncertainty, and uncertainty specifically about tariffs and what's coming. How worried are local people, businesses, individuals, government entities, by the economic impact of his policies so far, and by the fact that if these tariffs kick in at any level commensurate with what he's promised, that it's going to affect prices across the board?
I think it's absolutely on the mind of government and business. Obviously, Charlotte is a huge hub for the banking and finance sector. This will have massive impacts on their operations. I think in terms of the average Charlottean, they're not necessarily feeling as much impact yet, but as we see these tariffs start to take effect, if prices start going up, if people start to see tangible impacts in their 401ks, people will start paying a whole lot more attention as the effects start to trickle down to the average person beyond those business sectors and local government.
Michael, Trump has claimed the mantle of FDR's first 100 days, which I already went through at the very beginning of the program, and described by the Washington Post as he rewrote the relationship between Americans and their government, speaking of FDR. But where Roosevelt was attempting to use the government to positively impact people's lives and expand government presence in those lives to end the Great Depression, Trump seems intent on dismantling the government and getting it out of people's lives. If he is successful, will he be taking the country back to a pre-FDR period? And if so, what might be the result?
Wow. So that's a question for an entire hour, I would say, if Charlotte talks, but I'll give it a stab here.
Can you come back tomorrow?
Sure. I think what the New Deal did was fundamentally reshape and put emphasis on what the federal government can do in terms of particularly broader economic dynamics. And it fundamentally reshaped the relationship and the power structure within our society to say the national government has power and capabilities to be able to do, as you indicated, good things. And we saw the rise of the administrative state in ways that we could not have possibly imagined before 1932, but we have come to expect. I think where we are now is certainly trying to dismantle so much of that federal power, but shifting that power in directions that may not necessarily send it back to the states or send it back to the people, but consolidate it within one branch or more particularly one office. And that's the presidency. And we've seen the presidency grow in terms of power and Congress abdicate their role in terms of countering that presidential ambition. The courts are starting to say, whoa, you can't do these kinds of things. And we're seeing the pushback from the White House on that as well. So I think we're kind of in, we won't go back to pre-1932, but we are in a very different environment of consolidation of power into basically what I see as the Oval Office.
In the first 100 days, Reuben, of the FDR administration, the Congress, the 73rd Congress, played a major role in working with the president, enacting laws to enable his policy prescription. And many of those laws were enacted with an abundance of bipartisan support. What has this Congress done in these first 100 days to either advance or thwart the Trump agenda?
Yeah, well, it's certainly not bipartisan, although the Democrats in the Senate did end up helping Republicans keep the government open. That certainly backfired on Chuck Schumer among his own party, a number of Democrats saying, why aren't you standing up? But, you know, there are a number of kind of question marks in terms of what may come with this Congress and the Trump's agenda in terms of his approach on taxes and his approach on Democrats' fear about cuts that could be coming to Medicaid. And there are a number of other things. But, you know, as you allude to, Mike, so much of what the first 100 days has been marked by has not necessarily been in Congress. It's been through executive action, executive orders, which have just been have come incredibly quick, and it's frankly hard to keep track of them all. Some of them, I will say, carry a lot more weight than others. Some of them, the legality is in question for sure. And so, you know, as a reporter, it's up to us to keep track of all these because there are certainly a heck of a lot of them.
And Michael, all of them, all of these executive orders, every single last one of them, can be reversed by the next occupant of that office because they are not laws. They are executive orders. So is this a wise political policy? If they really want these new initiatives to be part of the fabric of the country, why isn't the Congress doing that job, passing laws?
Because Congress is, in a word, dysfunctional. You can't get things through Congress. You know, remember, you've got a bare majority in the House made up of a coalition of Republicans that may not always agree on everything that the Republicans want to pass. And then you've got a Senate where there are not 60 votes to pass things. You would have to get Democrats on board, and there's no middle ground left in Congress. So, you know, the court of play, the ping pong ball, has been tossed squarely into the Oval Office. And yes, they are issuing these executive orders thinking that they're going to be embedded for all eternity. It only takes a different administration and a different president coming in 2029 to say, nope, all of these get reversed, and I'm going to install my own slew of 100-plus executive orders in the first 100 days. You did 100, I'm going to have 150, and we're just going to continue to escalate as we move through these presidencies.
Well, as I said, he did 139 in the first 75 days. Mary, around the country and here in North Carolina, we seem to be the poster child for protests at town hall meetings in North Carolina. At least the television people are covering us substantially. Republican members of Congress, when they hold these town hall meetings, are being met with vitriol from a lot of their constituents. A loud, maybe it's minority, I don't know, it doesn't sound like from the crowd, but a loud bunch of people out there who are very angry about a lot of what's going on. Are these a small minority of voters? Are these people who are protesting at these town halls, as Donald Trump said, paid Democratic organized troublemakers? Who are these people that are complaining?
I think in a lot of ways, it's the same grassroots organizations that we saw spring up in the wake of Trump's first election in 2016, groups like Indivisible, that were sort of these very community-led grassroots organizations. That being said, I don't think we ever really got to see what sort of full effect they could have because the 2020 presidential election was so shaped by the ongoing COVID pandemic. So it'll be interesting to see if these groups are able to achieve any sort of critical mass and reach people beyond those who are already pretty wonkish, pretty plugged into their local politics, and really reach people that are less engaged and get any sort of large scale community groundswell. Obviously, as you mentioned, there have been some events at town halls. There have been some sizable protests in Charlotte and around the country. But again, these are things we kind of saw the last time around, never really got to see what their full effect was because the COVID pandemic just upended so many parts of life. So it'll be interesting to see as we head into the midterms and the next presidential election, what sort of tangible impacts these groups can have. Do they start spouting their own candidates as we saw with the Tea Party on the Republican side during the Obama administration?
Very few Republicans have spoken out against any of these policies, any of these initiatives. One senator, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, did reference the fear that she says she has felt under the Trump administration. She wasn't specific about exactly what the nature of that fear was. North Carolina's Tom Tillis asked during a hearing who he could choke if these tariffs did not work out. That sounds mild, but nonetheless, it is doubt. And expressing doubt by a Republican is fraught with peril, it seems to me. As a Republican, can you take issue in any way with any of this? Can you be a centrist? Or do you have to be a MAGA Republican in order to survive? Mary.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you are. I think in a state like North Carolina, it's certainly a concern for a Tom Tillis who has to appeal to voters who just a few months ago elected Donald Trump as president and also elected Josh Stein, a Democrat, as governor. Obviously, in the Charlotte area, you're not going to be able to get a seat on, say, the Charlotte City Council, I think, by fully leaning into a Trump agenda. You know, you're not going to see a Councilman Ed Driggs going to rallies in a red hat talking about immigration. He's going to talk about his finance background. He's going to talk about very middle of the road development policies and his leadership on transportation, these local issues. So I think in a state like North Carolina, you have to toe that line very carefully. That being said, I think there are other parts of the country where you can really lean into that MAGA agenda. We see that with folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Nancy Mace down in South Carolina has really fully embraced Trump. She won her first election on a very centrist, somewhat anti-Trump agenda, and has now fully leaned into his camp. So it really depends on where you are.
I know Michael Bitzer wants to chime in on this, and I have a question about Tom Tillis because you've conducted a poll and you have some approval numbers on him as well. And I don't know whether they were before or after his comment about choking the person responsible for the tariffs, but we'll find out when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the first 100 days of the second Trump administration. Dr. Michael Bitzer is here. He's a professor of history and politics and chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College. Reuben Jones is a Washington reporter for Spectrum News. One and Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Michael, we were talking about can you be a centrist Republican in this era? And Mary was waxing poetic, and you wanted to jump in, so I'll let you do it. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to follow up. You had mentioned Lisa Murkowski, the Republican senator from Alaska, and her comments. And I think what she said was really instructive in that she said, because retaliation is real. And I think the key word there is retaliation. Retaliation in the primary elections. If you are not seen as being fully loyal to President Trump and to his agenda, he will come after you. He is the kingmaker in Republican Party politics. And I think she recognizes it. I think Senator Tillis, with his whose throat do I choke, you know, basically is getting at who do I blame if I have to face a highly competitive re-election bid next year in 2026's midterm elections. I think the fear of the president coming out against you, endorsing somebody else as your primary candidate. These folks want to win re-election, but they've got to win renomination first and foremost, and the Republican Party is in the control of Trump.
You know, Trump and a lot of Republicans now say the quiet part out loud, and perhaps that is what is shocking to a lot of people, because he's not the first president to make threats to political enemies and even members of their own party to get them in line. LBJ was famous for that. I'm sure that FDR did the same thing, and probably other Republican presidents as well. Is the process being used, aside from the rhetoric that we as the public get to hear, as opposed to the Oval Office conversations and the conversations on the phone to individual people in Congress, is this approach really any different?
To me, I mean, you referenced FDR. He wanted to go after conservative Southern Democrats who are not falling in line with his New Deal, more liberal agenda, particularly on race issues, but also economics. So he tried that. LBJ had the classic LBJ treatment where he would literally tower over you and point his finger into your chest and say, "This is what you're going to do because I'm president of the United States." What I see Trump being able to do is really use the base of the Republican Party, the primary voters who are so in lockstep with the president that they will follow whatever lead he tells them to follow. And I think that that's the power that the president has within at least Republican Party politics.
I'm sorry, Ruben, go ahead.
Sorry, Mike. And I think it's not just politicians. I mean, the president has targeted universities. He's targeted not just members of Congress, but the governor of Maine when there was sort of this awkward interaction they had between the two over the question of rights for people who are transgender. And so it sort of branches out from just, hey, you might have a primary challenge in the Republican primary. It goes well beyond that in terms of the potential backlash someone could face if they speak out against the president.
I want to come back to Tom Tillis, because we were talking about Tom Tillis prior to the break, Michael, and Catawba College in their poll, which you said, I believe was conducted in March. Tom Tillis had a 41% approval rating with a 37% disapproval rating. I don't know whether that was before or after his choking comment, but he's taken some moderate stances or wavering stances on some Trump policies. Is that because of that? And what can we glean from those numbers?
I'd be very cautious on trying to glean anything other than there is room on both sides for Tillis to kind of navigate this very delicate dance he has to do going into his reelection bid in 2026. I was not surprised by the fact that over 20% of North Carolina's respondents did not know or did not have an opinion on Tillis. I think once you get past the president, people's, you know, attention span and engagement tends to lag in that regard. So these were numbers that didn't surprise me in the least. What I think we will need to see is, where does the movement shift moving forward over the next year and a half? And I think Tillis is kind of in a very classic position here in North Carolina. He's got to face some considerable headwinds because the president's party always loses seats. But the number of states where that headwind is going to be strongest, one of them North Carolina, another one Maine, there are very few states that have a capable competitive environment, North Carolina being one of the major ones, for Democrats to pick up seats. They are going to have to win in states that are not Democratic friendly if they're going to have a chance of winning control of the U.S. Senate back.
One of the hallmarks of this first 100, there have been a couple, but one of them is through Elon Musk and Doge, the shuttering of, the closing down of agencies, the mass firings of people and the rehirings of some of those same people, the cutting off of USAID funds around the world. much of this is legally questionable because Congress opened these agencies and Congress funds these agencies and they decide whether they deserve the money, not the president. Have any of Trump's predecessors done anything remotely similar to what appears to be skirting the law, Michael?
Nobody comes really to mind because all former presidents, past presidents, have recognized they have to deal with Congress. Congress is the appropriator. Congress establishes these administrative agencies. They give power to these administrative agencies. Presidents have some flexibility in terms of who they appoint as leaders and how, you know, power can be utilized, where the focus is going to be. But this has become a real issue of congressional negligence in terms of we appropriate this money. We tell the president, spend this money on these programs. The president is choosing not to do so. We've seen past presidents try and do something similar, Nixon, for example, and the courts have basically said, if Congress makes you do it, you have to do it. And now Congress is basically saying, well, there's nothing we can do about it, or they're just ignoring it. I think that's where we kind of are.
And the third branch of government is kind of on a precipice as well with regard to what's been happening in the first 100 days. The Trump administration deported hundreds of undocumented migrants to El Salvador, to a prison in El Salvador without due process. Trump has so far found ways not to comply with court orders to bring that man back to this country for due process. Last week, Trump's FBI agents arrested Judge Hannah Dugan for allegedly aiding an undocumented immigrant avoid apprehension at her courthouse. ICE came in, evidently, into her courtroom and arrested her. And by all reports, they did not have a legal arrest warrant. They simply arrested her. He has threatened the media, he has threatened law firms, he has threatened universities, any and all people and institutions who don't adhere to his worldview and his agenda. This is unquestionably un-American, Michael. But how much of it is illegal? And if he refuses to follow court orders, will it matter?
So we are, in my estimation, in very dangerous territory. In terms of, are we a rule of law or are we a rule of a single man kind of a system of governance? And where we are seeing the foundations clearly, very clearly being laid is if you challenge the president, he will use the power and resources of his office to come after you. And we have seen courts stand up to the president. We have seen courts tell him that you have to do things. And as you indicated, he has ignored them so far. We'll see how far this gets pushed. But institutions are made up of individuals. And if individuals don't have the backbone to stand up for basic American fundamental values and principles, we have lost the Democratic Republic and we are in what some political scientists call competitive authoritarianism.
And Ruben, it's one thing for the Congress to get in lockstep behind the president on policy. It is another thing to allow him to flaunt the law. And if you ignore court orders, you're not only flaunting the law, you are setting up a constitutional crisis, the only remedy for which I can find is impeachment. That is not going to happen under the current Congress because it's Republican controlled. So what are people behind the scenes saying about what's going to happen if he refuses to obey the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I don't think people exactly know. I mean, as Dr. Bitzer alludes to and can speak to better, we are in sort of uncharted territory in that respect. And I think for Congress, they are sort of in uncharted territory as well. Look, there was an impeachment put forward by a Democratic lawmaker just yesterday, in fact. But, you know, as you say, Mike, that isn't going to amount to anything. So Democrats are taking different approaches in terms of what to do. But in terms of the question of constitutional crisis, I think it's just there's too many question marks.
Because of DOGE, Mary, and the haphazard approach to cutting government, a lot of Americans appear frightened by this, particularly when it comes to ending government programs, entitlement programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Which of any of these cuts that we've witnessed at the federal level seem to be resonating positively or negatively at the local level?
I think the Social Security cuts have gotten a lot of attention locally. We saw a decent-sized rally just a couple of weeks ago featuring Alma Adams at a Social Security office here in Charlotte. I think that's just Social Security is a very tangible thing for people. There are so many people in our community living off of that fixed income, and even the slightest change, the slightest disruption could have massive impacts on their daily lives. And then I think, you know, for a lot of people I've talked to, a lot of organizations, they're still uncertain. My colleagues at The Observer, and I have a lot of reporting on this coming out later this week, but so many of the community organizations we've reached out to, and these are groups people know, like Roof Above, Habitat for Humanity, The United Way, you know, a lot of their answer is, we just don't know. There are things we're hearing that would definitely impact their operations, but they're still trying to figure out exactly what is and isn't going to happen amid challenges and, you know, backpedaling and things like that. So for a lot of people, it's just a lot of uncertainty right now.
Ruben.
You know, Mike, I think one of the big issues for North Carolina is Helene recovery, right? And so what we've seen, I've done quite a bit of reporting on this the past few weeks and talked to the governor about this yesterday, is that you are seeing, yes, you are seeing an increase in services in North Carolina in terms of debris removal, but you're also seeing cuts to AmeriCorps. People who are practically volunteers who have been within overnight eliminated from their role. You saw a CDC team that was devoted to Helene recovery eliminated. I'm hearing some other cuts that I'm working on chasing down today. So there are a lot of cuts, and as Mary alludes to, a lot of cuts happening that agencies, small organizations are really just finding out through the grapevine, and they're finding out very quickly, and it's leaving a lot of people, I think, in sort of these difficult positions where they don't know if they're going to have a job or not. And I'll just say, Mike, even if someone loses a job, we've seen this a lot within HHS, which I cover pretty closely, Health and Human Services Department, even if they lose their job, they may be called back because DOGE may have cut them and then realized, oh, wait, we actually need that person in this position. So they'll bring them back if they can. And so it leaves these federal workers and these volunteers in these different positions in a really difficult spot where they don't know the job security for themselves.
Presidents try to accomplish a lot in their first 100 days because sometimes that's all they got, because the midterms start looming large and there's usually a changeover in Congress from the party of the president every 2 years, which is part of our problem in this country, I think. But there's something called political capital. And you spend it quickly in the first 100 days, and you may be able to keep it, but if you lose it, that's when trouble brews, because even members of your own party start to question you. And if prices continue to rise, if the stock market continues to fall because of his peripatetic approach to tariffs, and Republicans in Congress are facing midterms, will they take steps, Ruben, to rein him in?
Remember that Trump 2.0 was a lot different than his first term. This is a Congress, a Republican Congress, that is almost unilaterally behind this president. And as Dr. Bitzer knows well, this is a president who has managed to garner support among Republicans that just doesn't fold. It doesn't bend as easy as it might for another president. Having said that, the economy drives people to the polls. If the economy tanks, don't expect every Republican to stand behind the president. That would be what I would think.
Michael, just released NBC News poll asked voters which party fights for people like you. 38% said neither. 24% said Republicans. 23% said Democrats. What needs to change so the Democrats can better connect with the voters, because they have a brand problem?
certainly they have a brand problem, and I think they're trying to figure out what their message is in terms of going into next year's midterm elections. You've heard Illinois Governor Kritzinger talk about some road tests, some things. We've seen California Governor Newsom road test some messages. They're probably preparing for 2028, but Democrats have to get their message for next year. And it probably will be, we are not Trump and we're not the Republicans.
In 10 seconds, is there anything that will change people's minds who are solidly entrenched behind Trump?
No.
Dr. Bitzer. No. Okay. Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history at Catawba College, Reuben Jones, Washington reporter for Spectrum News 1, and Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.